Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick O'Sultry. Coach Osello, I heard that we're going to get a little bit of a glimpse of a raspy voice out of you.
Listen, I'm going to get ahead of the story right now. I'm in Kansas City. When you get me, I'm not the guy that shows up and says, hey guys, watch me sting a corner 75 times in a row. Thanks for the check. How you doing? See ya. I'm out there. I'm taking defensive shifts. I'm screaming rotate as loud as I can. I'm a little sunburnt. I didn't put SPF on the head because the Kansas City sun just was peeking through the crowd. So I didn't think I needed it. Turns out I did. And more importantly, I go out. I'm the best coach with the kids, but we're gassing beers as a coaching staff after the camps and clinics. So we go to a loud bar. I'm not going to not be the man with hilarious stories and anecdotes and whimsical, wacky nature, Nick.
So it was a lot on the vocal cords.
It was a lot on the vocal cords. I did give up carbonation for Lent, so I was drinking vodka waters.
Okay.
Kind of a weird move at like a sports bar to be like, could I get a vodka water?
I'm a 78-year-old woman, and where's your cigarette vending machine? I need to re-up my Virginia Slims.
Vodka water, two limes, please, two limes.
Yes.
So, with that being said, hey, it's starting to become spring's right around the corner. We saw a full slate of snow in February games just to get us nice and cold and humble. Basketball's picking up. We had some sixes stuff that we'll talk about at the end of the episode, but I'm full on like enjoying my life as a sports fan, which some people get that Super Bowl, that post Super Bowl lull. Maybe these games don't really matter, but for the third week in a row, I'm going to say these games are so much more fun now that I gaslit myself into thinking that everything matters way more than it does because Notre Dame got incriminated last year. And Terry, let's just start off with the statement victory of the decade. Notre Dame is so sick. They absolutely off the top turnbuckle RKO'd Georgetown into Bolivia. Is this the year Notre Dame takes it all? We'll see. So to put my other serious hat on, I thought they did, generally speaking, everything well. And that was the thing that most impressed me in their 15-8 victory. Not a single area in which they didn't look at least solid. They jumped out to a 9-3 lead after a somewhat close first quarter. Another big story is Brian Tevlin. He's a do-it-all guy. He was taking shifts as first line middie, second line middie, short stick D middie, goalie. I think he made some hot dogs at halftime. I think that he drove the bus home. This is a guy, you tell him to jump, he says how high and has bunnies out of the gym. Chris Fake shut down Dordovic. Eric Dobson shoots absolute piss missiles. He had three, as did Gray and Chris Kavanaugh. Terry, what do you take away from the first true statement win for this Irish team?
So I was in the building for this one, and I literally was not settled before it felt like the game was over, just to give you a sense of how thoroughly they controlled it from beginning to end. And for the listeners, Nick does get to write the outline, but I tell him the order of games we want to talk about. And this, I think, was the first game to talk about, because even though we had a number one versus, I believe, number three, I don't remember where Ohio State was ranked, I had them number three in my poll. And we'll get to that next. This was more important because, you know, essentially from a landscape-wide standpoint, the way I see it is you've got Virginia, Notre Dame, and then potentially Cornell. Kind of depends on whether or not you put more weight on their performance against Lehigh or more weight on their performance against Albany, which wasn't quite as impressive in their opener. But you got those two. You got Virginia and Notre Dame at the top. Then you may or may not have Cornell kind of like in a tier by themselves. And then you just got everybody else from four to the bottom. And so, you know, is that going to persist? Probably not. I think that a combination of history and the way this month has unfolded suggests that, you know, Notre Dame and Virginia are going to find some speed bumps, potentially as early as next week. That being said, for right now, they are very clearly the two best teams. And I think to your point about Notre Dame doing everything well, everybody agrees with that, including Kevin Corrigan, except for their clear against a 10-man ride. and Kevin Warren, who said in his post-game comments that he felt like they were a Final Four team, a Memorial Day team. So, you know, it's interesting. Chris Kavanaugh got hit and stayed down after scoring a goal pretty late in the game. And it just occurred to me that I felt like, and this is not a criticism of Chris Kavanaugh, it's a compliment to the rest of the group. He felt like a luxury item, right? It was like, I don't expect them to miss a beat when they have to bring in whoever their fourth attackman is to play a little bit more. I think Bryce Walker, you know, it was Eric Dobson on Saturday, and that was important because he represents something that just changes the way defense have to approach, right? When he is hammering 16 and 17 yard step downs, it just stretches defenses so far. And then when they're stretching out to him and closing out aggressively and you know, playing him at greater distances than you would pretty much anybody else, and then he puts, you know, he throws the sword in the sheath and runs right past you on a face dodge and, you know, stings it on the run, well, then all of a sudden the scramble drill gets even more chaotic and more difficult. And so, you know, when he is on and when he scores early, what it does to defenses is really, really important. But Bryce Walker, you know, I went back and watched the Cleveland State and Marquette games and came away with even more impressed by him than his stat line suggested. And, you know, I've said and written for the first 2 weeks that the most important storyline of the first half of their season was going to be Jeffrey Riccardelli or in that role of the third attackman, because Jake Taylor's insertion into the starting lineup keyed or coincided directly or caused the second half season run. So what were they going to look like early in the year without Jake Taylor when he, you know, tore his ACL again? So, and they're getting production, right, from that spot, and they're getting production from, you know, all over their midfielders. You know, you mentioned Brian Tevlin, and certainly he was awesome, but Quinn McCann was essentially the same thing. Brian Tevlin played long stick on man down. Like, have you ever heard of a MIDI doing that? Is that crazy? You do it in Colorado high school.
Yeah.
Like 4A.
Well, first off, you know, that's one of the toughest divisions in all of, you know, high school lacrosse in the country. But no, for a damn good college lacrosse team, having someone to step in with a pull on man down is representative of something that's impressed me from the get-go with this Notre Dame team, which is a higher IQ than certainly my tenure there, because like you said, Dobson stretching the defense makes it such a worse situation to game plan against when the prevailing threat is good passing and predicting where the defense is going to be and feeding the crease. I feel like the attack, well, yes, they have some good dodges. Yes, they have. It's that collective IQ that if you're not paying attention off ball, it's going to be a, you know, kind of game over situation. And I am going to try and respect the listeners and not just make this the Homer Notre Dame podcast. Of course, we're the best team in the country. We're the most handsome, coolest alumni. Terry, is this panic time for Georgetown? This and teeing up the spectrum of is this team good versus did their opponent play bad, I felt like was a theme for this weekend. So kicking off with this spectrum, Georgetown panic button, how hard do you hit it?
Yeah, that's actually a much better question than is it panic button time, because the answer is both yes and no. It is panic button time from the standpoint of now is the time to make drastic changes, but it's not panic button time in the sense that, you know, they beat Princeton. Obviously, Princeton lost to Maryland yesterday, so who knows what the Tigers are going to look like. But, you know, they beat Princeton. They beat Villanova, who got a nice win on Sunday over Delaware, a previous top 10 team. They beat High Point and Richmond in their non-conference. Like, you're looking at four top 20 wins, potentially two top 10 wins from that group. That is a reasonable resume to get an at-large bid and you know, be on the borderline of hosting a game. So their season is still in front of them, despite the fact that they are 3-0. The difference, and it's funny because, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking and talking about this, even though I'm not going to have Georgetown in my top 20 on Monday, but I am going to talk about them in the context of dropping out. And I think there's a lot of Georgetown, well, not I think there are a lot of Georgetown haters. There are a lot of Georgetown haters, and they chirp me a lot, as if I'm like a Georgetown proponent. But whatever. You know, it's as if they didn't beat. It's as if they didn't beat Penn and Notre Dame last year. Like, those games actually happened. And then when you start to make the argument, well, that was last year and this is this year. And first of all, like, Gibson Smith and Owen McElroy and Alex Mazzone are awesome. Like, I'm not gonna dismiss that. But at the same time, and Dylan Watson too. And I'll come back to that. But at the same time, they also played well in scrimmages against Maryland and Virginia, who are good, right? So, you know, the issue is they may have played well and just lost to Hopkins and Penn, and maybe they didn't play well, right? That's kind of in the eye of the beholder as far as the coaching staff is concerned. But it is very clear they did not play well against Notre Dame. And it is also very clear that at the offensive end of the field, like, it's just not working. And, you know, for me, in terms of what I have seen, I think there are multiple issues that need to be solved, but the first issue that needs to be solved is I see four guys looking to get Tucker Dordovic and Graham Bundy the ball so that they can get to their spots and get their shots off, as opposed to the ball flowing, finding the energy from the ball, and the guy with the best shot taking the shot. And, you know, it's a combination of guys deferring, passing up looks, not being assertive as Dodgers. And it just rolls up into the fact that, like, you know, again, I mean, this game, you mentioned that the themes of the weekend, I guess. Like, for me, two things that stood out were runs, right? And particularly, like first half explosions. So we saw Yale fall behind to Penn State. We saw Carolina win on the strength of a great second quarter against Syracuse. In this one, I mean, obviously Notre Dame was dominant throughout, but they really separated in the, you know, middle part of that first quarter. And when you were watching Georgetown's offensive possessions in that stretch, they just didn't have any ideas. It felt like Carolina in the first half against Hopkins and Hopkins in the second half against Carolina. Like, I've seen it a few times so far this year, and it doesn't mean it's going to stay. It doesn't mean that there isn't a solution. It doesn't mean that there isn't a fix to this. It just means that right now, they're pretty bad, especially compared to the talent that we know that they have.
I mean, wow, for someone who's just been forcing Georgetown to everybody, apparently. Interesting to hear you give some good critiques. And speaking of explosiveness, we can move on to the second game, which is I can't get over this Virginia offense. You know, against an Ohio State defense that we were talking about did a great job against North Carolina last week, holding them to, I think, 5 goals, which is certainly a feat in Division I college lacrosse against,
as we saw him put up 17 against Syracuse, yeah, or 18 or 19, whatever it was.
Yeah, and so against a good, objectively good Ohio State defense, Virginia put up 17. And conversely, that didn't even feel like the story of the game to me. They held Ohio State to 6. So an 11-point win that just makes UVA, you know, if you were scared of them before, which you should have been, I don't know how scared you can possibly get. Cormier had 7, which led the offense, and an impressive performance from Cade Saustad. Did I get that right?
Texas boy, you got it right. Put that sauce on it.
I don't like that. I want to keep mispronouncing names, so I'll say
Saustad. I'm sure you'll get one mispronounced in this podcast. Don't worry about it.
But again, I feel like a lot of success that Ohio State has is because of Myers, and he held Myers to 2 goals. And a 7-4 lead into half, this is what makes this Virginia team scary. They were up 7-4, which doesn't feel like an insurmountable lead. In fact, I would say that that's pretty close. Ohio State's probably feeling good about themselves. They just come out and blow the doors off of them, again, with that final score being 17-6. So 7-4 turning into 17-6. You know, just the ability to put teams away and take, like, one quarter of good Virginia lacrosse is the most powerful thing in Division One. And how much weight are you putting on this game for, like, the who is good eye test? Not a good look for Ohio State.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm putting a lot of weight on it from the standpoint of Virginia is clearly the number one team, which, you know, based on what I saw from them in the fall, what I heard about them in the, you know, kind of early season scrimmages, and even, you know, what we saw from them from game one, I was still not, like, lukewarm. It was just, I could be convinced that there is a better team. But based on what we saw against Harvard and now based on what we've seen against Ohio State, who is a bona fide opponent, which isn't to say Harvard isn't. It's just to say that, you know, we hadn't seen Harvard play yet this year. So now, you know, you do this to a Buckeye team in a neutral site location, right? So, you know, that obviously levels the playing field. You have to take notice. And you're right in terms of the clamps, the second half clamps, the two goals in the second half. It stands out for sure. I think the Cade Staustad point is an important one, right? And I compared it a lot to, you know, he got injured last year. Brett Makar was playing with an injury. The way that Cole Kastner, and I love Cole Kastner in terms of his game, right? Like, just the ability to be disruptive as the guy who covers the opponent's second-best player. And that means that you have a little bit more opportunity to hedge and slide, double from the backside, play passing lanes and pick passes off. And he did all that. And then, you know, be on the inside, right? Because you're in a supporting position when a shot comes off. So you're in a position to pick up the rebound, or if the Dodger tries to get to the dirt and he runs into two sticks and the ball's on the ground, you can be there too. Like, he's just a very productive player. And all of that is to say that, like, there was a point at the end of last season when I thought that Ajax Apatela was better than Brett Makar, and I thought that Cole Kastner was better than Cade Staustad. But ultimately what it comes down to is taste. And if you're a coach, and most coaches are like this, who are just like, you know, I want the guy who's going to guard the opponent the best. Well, Cade Staustad is better. And he showed himself to be incredibly exceptional on Saturday night. And I think that, but again, like, you can play well defensively, and this game was still going to be, you know, 10-6, and it was going to be competitive all the way through. But the simple fact is that Virginia can beat you in all three facets of the game in convincing fashion, right? And I think that the defensive performance was kind of the last thing we needed to see this year in order to feel good about that, because, you know, after the game became non-competitive against Harvard, we didn't see a consistent defensive performance. But Petey Lasala, his ability to score is just such a game changer because of the way that it is so deflating. If you score and then you go to the faceoff X and Petey Lasala scores on you, it's just like, ugh, you know what I mean? It feels like you gave up more than one goal's worth of goals. And then offensively, you know, it feels like we still haven't seen Connor Schellenberger get unlocked, and yet they are so potent. I think that it's easy to kind of like overreact to Peyton Cormier's production line, but when you kind of look at the film over the last three games, I didn't notice this until it was shared like in our group Slack, but a lot of credit is being given to Thomas McConvey, because he and Cormier, I believe, are both Mimico guys and have played together since they were like 7 years old. So their familiarity with each other's game, you know, has really unlocked a lot of Cormier. And what's interesting is that, like, you would kind of assume that meant that he was just catching and finishing a lot. But because Ohio State decided to guard him with a short stick, which was really effective strategy last year, Peyton himself conceded that when he talked to McNair after the game, he saw more dodging out of him this game. And that level of versatility, and particularly that level of athlete. I mean, we have made a lot of what a 230-pound dodging midfielder who was an outside linebacker at Stanford 2 months ago means to opposing defenses. But we also have this 235, 240-pound Canadian who might not be in the best shape, objectively speaking, but in terms of how
shape, and they're still nasty. So
in terms of how he wants to play, like, you know, momentum equals four. What is it? It equals MC squared. Energy equals force times mass, or I don't know. You're the mathematician. You're the Notre Dame degree.
Times acceleration.
There you go. So the amount of energy he's bringing to his dodges is directly proportional or caused by his mass. And he has cultivated it effectively over his career in Charlottesville. And now it's peaking. He bulk season is over. And now it's time to go to the goal.
Well, and it's, you know, even rewinding the tape to last year, one of the things that, you know, I almost didn't like about Maryland was that, in the same way watching like Peyton Manning, the mistakes just aren't there. Like, the way to beat this team is just not there. So, like, watching Maryland, it was like, well, it didn't matter if that team had a great offensive performance because Maryland was going to win the special teams, you know, the man up, the man down, the defense, and the goalie. And is it fair to kind of start talking about that way in Virginia, or is the inconsistency from defense, like, is this team bulletproof because they just have one quarter where it can completely get away? Or is it not a fair comparison at all?
Well, it's certainly not a fair comparison at all, because to this point, yes. But I guess my argument would be we need more than three games in order to, like, make the consistency argument, especially for a team where, like, they did put up some stinkers, you know, particularly the two games against Maryland. Like, that was my whole thing about Virginia coming away from last season. It's like, why did they play Maryland as poorly as they did last year? Everything else about their resume was pretty strong, somewhere between strong to quite strong even. And so, yeah, I mean, I offensively, what interests me the most is, are they going to be disciplined not to take bad shots when they're feeling it, right? And you can be feeling it in a close game if your defense isn't playing well, and then what happens? So that's what I want to see out of the Cavaliers.
All right. Got it. And moving on to, you know, honestly, what seems like an effort to make you and I look stupid, because we were very, very high on Loyola last week. You know, we were talking about their imposing defense. We were talking about all kinds of stuff. Maybe Loyola creeps into that four spot, three spot behind Notre Dame and Virginia. And then they go and lose to Rutgers. Low scoring game. One thing about this season that's kind of blown my mind, you see both teams scoring in the 20s when Virginia plays Harvard, and then Rutgers beats Loyola 10-6. A big part of the story is Shane Knobloch teeing off for 7 points, 3 goals and 4 assists. Loyola went on a 3-0 run at half, and it was tied 4-4. And they honestly couldn't get anything going the rest of the game. Rutgers, the big takeaway for me was they have at least two good players, Knobloch and their goalie Kyle Mullen. How on earth did they hold Loyola to 6? And a good weekend for the "is this team good or did the other team play bad" spectrum we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, well, you're right to call out Knobloch, because I think what was interesting about the way that fans expected this game to unfold was, you know, for Rutgers' first three games, they had been very attack-oriented, and it seemed as if the strength of Loyola's defense was, you know, we talked about this a lot last week, as you mentioned, just the length and size of their long poles. So, you know, I think that Loyola fans, if you'd said we're going to hold them to 10 goals, would have expected the team to have won. So, I think it's more so Rutgers' defensive performance against Loyola that really stands out. And, you know, I haven't gotten an opportunity to watch the film on this one, so the question that I want to know the answer to is, you know, how much of it was just cold shooting? You saw 0 of 5 from Seth Higgins, 1 of 8 from Adam Poitra, 1 of 7 from Evan James. You know, if that, I just feel like you can't make the argument that, you know, if one or two of those go the other way, it has the potential to dramatically change how the game unfolds. But it's the way I feel, right? And I think it's, especially in a game that's decided by this type of margin, it is true. And one of the other elements of that is that the thing that I could tell Charlie Toomey was really fixated on coming away from wins over Hopkins and Maryland was that they hadn't played on the road yet. And he knows that that is a different challenge. And it's not to say that, like, you know, every environment is the same and every road game is a significant challenge. Playing at Rutgers is tough. It's been established, right? It's on a 4 or 5 year run of it's hard to win at Rutgers. And, you know, whether it's the train whistle or something else that I don't know about and can't put my finger on, you know, the simple fact is that now that's still a challenge that Loyola needs to solve, right?
Tony Soprano yelling, you know, throwing a meatball sub at you.
It's all the gabagool from the night before and the pregame meal for sure.
Yeah, they load you up with the sauce the night before.
So, yeah, I mean, definitely a big result. Here's my take generally about these four, these other four top 20 matchups in which the lower ranked team won. Well, I guess there are three because Carolina was ranked ahead of Syracuse. Basically, what it just means is it's bringing it back to the middle, right? You know, gravity is bringing the bad teams to the up towards the middle, and they're bringing the good teams down toward the middle. And I don't think it means that the bad teams are bad and the good teams are good, or that the good teams are bad and the bad teams are good. I don't think it means anything like that. It just means that, you know, it's going to be a really even year. It's funny because I think everyone's wondered how much is the COVID, how much, when is the COVID year going to be peak impactful? And when are we going to see like the downside of it in terms of like super team separation between the best and the ones that can't take advantage of all the opportunities that the additional year of eligibility provided and everything that goes along with it. And at this point, and I understand we're, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in and it's February, at this point, it feels like last year was peak COVID year, and that this year we're seeing, just by virtue of the parity, the number of underclassmen that are contributing, it feels like we're getting a little bit more back to normal. And I do think that's going to manifest an inconsistency because you're relying on guys that have less experience, and so inconsistency is a function of a lack of experience. But I also think it's going to manifest in parity simply because, and results like what we saw, it's just hard to be dominant, right? What we saw out of Maryland last year was an outlier. It was a historic outlier. We hadn't seen it in 16 years. So, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, like, expect the unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that both the COVID year and even something like the transfer portal could result in inconsistencies because you have, I mean, even when I was talking to Coach Kevin Corrigan, who is the Notre Dame coach and, you know.
Oh, is he the Notre Dame coach?
Best coaches ever, and Notre Dame's a great program. He even called out that he was impressed with, you know, hey, so when you get transfers and when people come in and, you know, the portal and everything, there's not necessarily clashing cultures, but there's different cultures. There's how you go about practice, how, you know, you're obviously the X's and O's aspect of it, but also the culture aspect of it. Is it fair to say that the transfer portal, just like the COVID year, is having a potential impact? And if so, how much?
No question. I mean, but the thing is, there's no question that it's having an impact, but it's also, I think, impossible to say that it's having an impact in one direction or the other, because I think that there are too many examples of an infusion of talent meshing well and creating a team that's better than they would have been without those incoming transfers. And then there's also enough examples. I think Georgetown Notre Dame is a good example of this. There are examples of teams where it's easy to point to the infusion of talent not meshing well and saying that's the problem, right? So you're just going to play the results, but the results are available both directions right now. So yes, there is no question that the transfer portal is a part of it. But the other side of the coin is that, like, I mean, you're right to call it out. Like, we're dealing with a bunch of different situations. The COVID year allows kids to stay at some institutions longer, a year, or in some cases 2 years longer. It allows grad transfers to then graduate and go somewhere else. But that means, like, Ivy League schools aren't eligible to get those kids. Patriot League schools, service academies aren't eligible to get those kids. Service academies don't have guys staying an extra year at all, right? They're completely unaffected by it. And then there's the transfer portal, which makes it easier for undergrads to move, and theoretically makes it easier for every program to be a destination, because now they have, everybody has level access to knowing when a kid wants to transfer. Whereas back in the day, before the portal, it was all word of mouth. So it was essentially the same thing as recruiting, right? It just 2 years later. So I guess what I'm saying is that, like, there's no question it's having an effect, but it's not a one direction effect. So you can't say portal bad, grad transfer bad.
Because in some instances, it's good. That's important. Yeah. Portal, that's my caveman. Portal bad.
Yeah. That's what a lot of people want. Yeah, that's what a lot of people want.
If you tell me one more time that there's nuance and gray area to a subject that I just want to say bad or good, we're going to have a lot of problems. But again, that's why you're the nuanced smart guy, and that's why I'm the guy who threatens to fight people on Twitter and then backs down in real life. So, moving on to the next game, Duke versus Penn. I feel like this was tabbed almost as a specimen off, and the headline being Sam Hanley versus Brendan O'Neill. Major credit to Wilson Stephenson, who kept Hanley in check. Did I blow it?
Well, you just did it on purpose. There is no way you thought his name was Stephenson.
Maybe. Stephenson. Did I get that right? No, it's Stephenson. Stephenson.
Right, good job.
God,
yeah, the H is silent.
Yeah. So credit to him. He kept Hanley relatively in check all game. You know, again, we called it out kind of going off of explosive quarters. Duke took control in the second quarter, rattling off six straight, and then kept Penn scoreless for almost 25 minutes in a row. And by that point, it was relatively game over at 8-2. Although Penn did show a little life, rattling off four in a row in the third quarter, but it never got to a one-goal game. And how much of this was individual matchups? And a big question for me, what does Penn need to do to right the ship? So honestly, I need to know about this because I'm having a tough time formulating dumb opinions.
So the short answer to the question is Penn doesn't have to do anything. This is who Penn is. This is what they do. So they opened with a 2-goal win over Georgetown. They had a 2-goal loss to Duke. They don't play bad teams, right? So there's no breather. I mean, look at this schedule. At Penn State, who just beat Yale. At St. Joe's, who is probably the A-10 favorite and is undefeated. Home against Villanova, who just beat Delaware. Home against Princeton, who Penn Princeton was the best game of the year last season. At Cornell, home against Yale, at Brown, at Harvard. It's April 22nd when they host Dartmouth, and then April 26th when they travel to Albany. Like, those are the two games on their schedule where you would expect them to be favored by more than a goal and a half or 2.5 goals. I mean, it is just a gauntlet. And if history is any indicator, and it's not just 2022, we're talking like basically the entire Mike Murphy tenure, but certainly the last like 4, 5, 6 years, all these games are going to be 1 and 2 goal games. So what it's going to come down to, and this was something that I spent a lot of time talking to Sam Hanley about, is do you get better at winning close games? Because if you're talking to an analytics person, they basically say the clutch time performance reverts to the mean, right? And that if you are really aberrant in clutch time, one season, it's like turnovers in football. Then you're going to regress to being either bad or average the following year. And then there are some outliers. And, you know, the Phoenix Suns are an outlier in terms of how good they are in clutch time because Devin Booker and Chris Paul are excellent clutch time players. We're going to find out whether or not Penn is a 700 team like they were in clutch time last year, a 500 team or a 300 team. And it's going to be the difference in how their season goes. Because they're not going to play in blowouts. Like, they just, I mean, it's not who they are. So conversely, you know, they take on Duke, who was coming off of an overtime win over Denver at home 8 days prior. A game that you can kind of spin bad, right, in terms of what we would expect Duke to do against the Pioneers, who are outside of the top 20. But Denver played really well. And so, you know, it wasn't like they were playing the 30th best team in the country on the basis of the way that Denver played that day. And so you look at that, you say, all right, they rebound from a loss to Jacksonville. They beat Denver. They go to Franklin Field. We haven't talked about the conditions as being impactful on any of these games yet, possibly because one of them was played in Florida that we've already discussed. But like, point, all I'm trying to get at is that, like, analyzing this game is one of the most fruitless exercises because Penn is always only going to play close games. Duke has already shown themselves as being very inconsistent. And so if you're trying to take what happened on Saturday and use it to forecast what's going to happen in the future, like, don't. Like, what we are trying to find out right now is, like, are Penn and Duke between, like, the 7th and 16th best teams? Or are they between like the 4th and 12th best teams? That's like the question. That is like the only realistic question that we can try to get an answer to at the moment. And you know, it's kinda, I don't know. I feel if you put a gun to my head right now, I'm gonna take that higher tier just because it's a bet on the talent. We'll see.
Yeah, I love that analogy of like Penn and Duke need to be playing a lot of other teams that aren't each other to show what kind of teams Penn and Duke are because they're cut from the same cloth.
Well, I mean, you say that, but I would say like, no, like we know who they are. Like Penn's just going to play everybody to a 1 or 2-0 game and they're going to win some and they're going to lose some. And it's just a question of do they win a few more than they lose or do they lose a few more than they win? Whereas Duke, like they're going to blow Virginia out. right? They're going to beat Virginia by 10 goals. They do it every year. And so it's like not going to happen until mid-April. Just put it on the calendar right now. But then, you know, they might lose to St. Joe's, right? So I think that game already happened. If it didn't, no, it's coming up. I don't know. But either way, like the point is, like, don't try to figure out who Duke is. Duke is going to be determined by how good Duke's NCAA tournament resume is going to be determined by how good Syracuse and Carolina are, essentially.
Got it.
It's the only thing that matters about them. Yeah, they're going to go, you know, 11-5 or 12-4, and their seed or playoff selection is going to be determined by two teams that are not them.
I mean, just speaking from a podcast improvement standpoint, what a segue. Oh, Duke's going to be, you know, they're going to figure out when they play Carolina and Cuse. Speaking of, Carolina and Cuse played I watched a decent amount of this game. For me, it was just an inconsistent game for the Orange. The final score was Carolina 19, Syracuse 13. So Carolina walks away with a win in the Dome. If you think the Dome is the best place to watch college lacrosse, take a hike. It is not. Honestly,
Carolina it actually is.
Like, nope.
It objectively is.
Nope.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Always
day
70 degrees.
Beautiful.
It's like you're
day
outside.
In South Bend. Yeah, it's like you're outside. How about going outside, dorks?
Touch grass.
But yeah, touch grass, dorks. Carolina, honestly, a relatively balanced attack led by Logan McGovern, who went 4-4. Syracuse man up was honestly awesome to watch. They went 5-10 and had some viral clips that you might have seen posted. But it was another case of UNC jumped out to an early lead and maintained it throughout the entire game. Both teams had flashes of brilliance, but I feel like that sparked that 5 minutes where UNC took a lead was ultimately decided the fate of the end of the game. And who has a higher ceiling between these two teams is kind of what I came away with. I'm curious.
This year it's Carolina because they're old, and I think being old is really valuable in college sports. You know, the downside of bringing old guys, transfers, and some of these guys have multiple years left, is you only get them for a year or two. So you have to kind of immediately concern yourself with either, are you backfilling from your current roster? Or are you going to bring in more transfers? So, you know, from an intermediate and long-term standpoint, like next year and the next 2 years after that, it's Syracuse. But, you know, I'm going to take a victory lap on this one because, to me, this game did not unfold how I anticipated it was going to. So I'm not taking a victory lap on that. But this Syracuse team is essentially exactly who I thought they were going to be heading into the season, which is they are clearly, in my opinion, better than last year. They're a borderline top 20 team. They are capable of doing a lot of really good things, but they just haven't developed winning habits because young players don't know how to win college lacrosse games. You win college lacrosse games in very different ways than how you win high school lacrosse games, and you have to learn how to do it. And not only that, but you also have to learn how to not lose them too. Right, you tend to win them between like the 5 minute mark of the third quarter and the end of the game, right? The last 20 minutes. You can lose them in the second quarter, and I think that's a little bit of what we saw. Like, essentially, you know, Syracuse was so good on the extra man. They finished 5-10. And you know, they kind of got into a little bit of a rhythm, so they were a little bit more efficient in the 6-on-6 as the game went along. But ultimately, like, they just fell behind too far. It was almost like a college basketball March Madness game where they expend so much energy trying to get back into it that as soon as you tie it, it's like, oh, you know, it's like Valparaiso just went on a 17-2 run and they tied Oklahoma with 4 minutes to go. And then Oklahoma outscores them 12-1 down the stretch. And so that's kind of a little bit of what it felt like. I do want to call out one moment in the third quarter when Colin Krieg made a man-up save. Syracuse had scored 4 straight goals. I believe it was 14-11 at that point. And they went extra man. It was a really dangerous position for Carolina. You know, the type of spot where if Syracuse scores there, it is like real nut crunch time. And Concrete just totally bailed him out. And he only finished with 12 saves. He had been at 61%, I think, through their first 3 games. So he didn't play quite to the standard that he had played through the first part of the season. But that was a huge, I mean, just, you know, the type of play, it's just one note on the play-by-play. But for me, that was game-defining. I also want to interject a quick segment.
segment alert.
Segment alert.
Segment alert.
So, ESPNU / the ACC network is spotlighting like good things that players are doing during their broadcasts. Shocker, we're going to bring it back to Notre Dame. On the Carolina Syracuse game, they talked about Max Maniak's. It's not a business; it's a charitable organization. Pediatric pep talk. So essentially, it's the opportunity. I'm sure listeners to this are familiar with college sports teams adopting, kids who are going through different types of treatment, cancer treatment or other types of, serious health conditions, because it's great. It's great for the team. It's great for the kid. It's great for the families, that are experiencing this health situation or crisis with the kid. It's awesome. And so, essentially what Max created was an organization that allowed Notre Dame teams to do this remotely during COVID when it was really difficult to get into hospitals and stuff like that. So I want to create a similar segment on this podcast where I call out, we're just going to call it the good guy segment. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like people who did good stuff, although one of the three examples that I'm going to point to is somebody doing a good thing. But it could also be like, that individual came back from tremendous adversity or battled adversity or whatever. Yeah. And there are three guys that we've talked about in this podcast who have had stories written about them on Inside the Cross, but listeners might not know, so it's worth bringing up. So Brian Tevlin, who is now Notre Dame's do-everything midfielder, when he was a sophomore at Yale, the year after they won the national championship, so 2019, they were, it was the middle of the season, and he missed a couple games. I think this is right, but it might have been COVID. But no, I'm pretty sure it was 2019. It was after they beat Cornell. He donated bone marrow and missed like three games recovering from his bone marrow donation. So good guy, Brian Tevlin. Wilson Stevenson, you might remember in the, I guess maybe it was 2019 quarterfinals against Notre Dame at Hofstra, suffered a compound fracture of his tibia and fibula, I believe. There, Kevin Brown, who is producing this podcast, wrote an excellent story about his recovery because then they ended up playing. I can't remember if they played Notre Dame at Hofstra again, or they played Notre Dame in the quarterfinals, or they played in the quarterfinals at Hofstra again. Something crazy like that happened. But his leg looks not too dissimilar from what Alex Smith, the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers, Kansas City Chiefs fame, looks like. He's now featured in an UFAs commercial. Shout out to Wilson Stephenson for his tremendous physical recovery. And then lastly, Logan McGovern. This was actually Paul Carcaterra. They're both from Fairfield County, Logan McGovern and Carcar. So he talked about this in the broadcast. Anybody that watched it would know. But Matt Kinnear wrote a story last year when McGovern was finishing up his career at Bryant about how he has battled cystic fibrosis his entire life, which is a very, very dangerous disease that affects essentially like mucus-developing tissues and creates a lot of problems, specifically with your lungs, but a lot of other tissues in your body as well. And Matt Kinnear has had people in his life who have been affected by it, so it was really, kind of significant story for him to tell. But the fact that Logan McGovern is like 5'8", 160 pounds, and has battled with this his entire life, and is dropping 8 points on Syracuse's head in the Dome, when they brought him in, I don't know that they would have anticipated him starting, because he and Don Petromala theoretically were going to be the lefty attackmen. Obviously, Petromala is going to miss the season due to injury, which created an opportunity that McGovern seized with both hands. I mean, this kid has been playing lights out since fall scrimmage. So now, he's very clearly, in my estimation, their most important offensive player. I don't think, Lance Tillman is obviously the Dodger, another Colorado boy. Shout out to the Sunshine State. But yeah, Logan McGovern is so important in terms of finishing plays that we can't let what he's done in order to get to this point go unsaid.
You know what? I like that, the good guy segment. So let's put this on the listeners a little bit. If you guys have a good guy shout out, or if you know
somebody we hear about
doing
it.
Something cool, I want to hear about it. Terry might try to blackball the story. I want to be the guy that you reach out to so that we can spread positivity. And maybe we start recording on Friday, get a little positive Friday action. But no, three great great call-outs right there. Really cool stuff. Moving on to the next game.
Good guys playing in this one at all.
Yeah. I didn't say that. That was Terrence Foy. Maryland-Princeton in what was slated as a pretty big matchup. Honestly, it was Maryland who ended up winning 11-5. I feel like a big story was the first ever start in goaltender for the Maryland Terrapins, freshman Brian Ruppel, in his first ever start. And he played phenomenally, honestly, with 14 saves, and he kept Princeton to those measly 5 goals. The Terps O was led by Daniel Maltz, who had 4 goals. Jack Horace had 3, but their defense and goaltending stole the show. Terry, coming into this game, Princeton had scored 22 and 14, albeit against lesser opponents. How is it a team that's that objectively good? That's never easy to do in Division I. How are they held to such a low total?
So I don't think there's any question Maryland's defense is playing better. You know, probably better even than they did a week ago against Syracuse, and certainly better than they did against Loyola. You know, the short answer is, like, I don't know enough about goaltending play specifically. And we've talked about this a couple times already this season on the podcast, but the relationship between the 6-man unit's confidence in the goaltender to make the saves that the defense is designed to give up relative to their likelihood of making mistakes in other areas. Right. But I think, you know, one of the things that was so interesting about that Loyola Maryland game was how clear Loyola's offensive game plan was to avoid Brett Makar, Ajax Zapatello, and John Geppert, and attack Colin Burleson and the 2 short sticks, whoever was on the field at the time. And I would imagine that Maryland has spent a lot of time figuring out ways both to reinforce the performance of those 3 guys, right? But then also, you know, create situations that take away the offense's ability to dictate on those terms. But it's also a personnel function as well, too, right? Like, if you don't feel as comfortable initiating with your 3rd attackman or your 5th and 6th midfielder, you know, your 5th and 6th offensive option, your 2nd and 3rd midfielder on whichever line, then you can't necessarily deploy that strategy. So, yeah, there's a lot of potential reasons for this, but I also think that we should call out 2 things. The first is that, you know, Manhattan was 2-0 with a meaningful win over Navy last weekend, and then was beating Princeton at halftime on Tuesday. So, you know, that does both things. We've talked about this a lot. It makes you wonder how good Manhattan is, but it also makes you wonder, is Princeton not as good as we reasonably would have expected they would be? Or is it just early in the season, you know, 3 days rest, maybe looking ahead against Maryland, team that they lost to last year, etc. You know, and then I guess we get to the point where it's like, their biggest question coming into this season was, how are they going to replace Chris Brown? He was their offensive starter. He was their assist man. And, you know, they have so many pieces. I think through the first 2 games against Monmouth and Manhattan, it was very clearly going to be Colter McAsey. And there's just a difference between a Brett Makar or Ajax Zapatello versus who he had seen so far this season, who he's ever seen in his career, because he had never been drawing #1 defenseman. So I think that's like an area to see growth. And now, yeah, but also, you know, that's probably true for Braden Saris as well, who had been a really, you know, nice contributor for the Tiger offense to this point. You know, their midfield is excellent. Sammy English is, you know, arguably or one of the best offensive initiators from the midfield. And beyond that, they've got, you know, Alex Verdaro, who can also dodge poles, create offense. They've got Jake Stevens, who does everything. And then they've got additional depth, whether it's young guys or returning guys as well. So ultimately, what it all kind of like swirls up into is that, yeah, they lost because they only put up 5 goals, right? You can accept 11 goals, giving up 11 goals to Maryland and think that you deserve to win. I should note that, you know, we've talked a lot about goalie play. Princeton, goalie play, made the goalie change at halftime. Griffin Rackauer was awesome in the first half. I don't think they lost because of the goalie change, you know, but it is something to keep an eye on whether or not they keep sticking with it. So, yeah, they got to score more. And I'm going to chalk this one up to adjustment of everybody seeing that level of defender kind of for the first time in their college career.
I think one of the big things that I'm going to take away is we need to start calling more stick checks on faceoff guys if they score a goal.
How about that?
Classic. Wow. Honestly,
but he got it from pocket depth. Not for, yeah. Right? Wasn't, yeah, not for the, not for the shape of the plastic.
Yeah, which, honestly, 4D chess move, I feel like that's such an insult slap to the face that there's no coming back from that. You call a stick check on the face-off guy and it's illegal. You know, that's essentially goes against the Geneva Convention and, you know, other accords and agreements of those nature.
Name one other accord besides the Geneva Convention.
I'm literally trying to remember the one from Marvel, the Sokovia Accords. The Paris Treaty, the Treaty of Ghent, you know, the Louisiana
Treaty of Versailles.
Treaty of Versailles, Versailles is how you pronounce it.
Thank you.
But yeah, honestly, that was hilarious. I couldn't talk about that game without bringing it up.
I'm glad you did.
So for the listeners, I'm getting ready to go get on a flight. We have about 15 minutes left, so we'll get through some of these other games. The other big upset of the weekend, Penn State snatching a victory over Ivy powerhouse Yale. And Terry, as a guy who's just been shoving the Ivy League forward as well as Georgetown, it does me good to see the Ivy League have a down weekend. I know you're crying. I know you're sad about it, but
what library am I going to be able to go to in order to drown my sorrows?
Notre Dame's library. Anyway, Penn State snatches a victory. It kind of reminds us of last year where Penn State jumped out to a big lead and fended off a comeback. So 2 years straight of Penn State taking down Yale, not insignificant. Final score being 13-11. And 13-11 is coming off of an 8-1. Penn State was up 8-1 after the first quarter. Turns out the Ivy Leagues, you know, your boys, can't handle getting hit in the mouth. And credit to them for trying to claw back. The closest it was after that point is 10-8, which is a little bit scary, but it never got to a one-goal game after they went up 2-0, I believe. And the ball movement was the story for the Nittany Lions offense, I thought. To get such a lead stuck out to me, the off-ball movement and conversely the expecting the off-ball movement so that when there was that flash, there was the ball and there was the finish. What's happening in lacrosse? Nobody's safe. Yale loses to Penn State.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked about panic buttons, and if you're Yale, you can't press the panic button. You were in this exact same situation last year. Your Villanova win just got a little bit better with their win over Delaware, so you can take some small consolation in that. You know, last year, it was Alaric Fayak made 17 saves. How much of that was a hot goalie? How much of it was Huluba Hall, etc.? You know, this year, Jack Ferrecchia makes 16 saves, but, you know, in my, like, kind of, I had the game on the iPad while I was at Notre Dame Georgetown. And so from what I could gather, I haven't gone back and reviewed, it didn't seem illegitimate. I felt like Yale's offense let him down, candidly. Like that, I mean, the simple fact, and I think anybody that watched the Villanova game would come away with this conclusion, like, they play so fast that they're going to give up 13 goals to mediocre teams, right? It's like they can even be good. They're not good defensively right now, but they could be good defensively, and they would still give up 13 goals based on how fast they want to play offensively. And it just didn't have zip, right? And there's, you know, I wish I had a more scientific explanation for that. You know, like, I had a couple of people text me about how Brandow didn't come alive until late and, you know, that's a statement about him. And I'd rather have my best offensive player come alive late than, you know, basically like score the first three goals of the game and then disappear. So, you know, I kind of dismiss that. I think that there's a really interesting kind of challenge geometrically to be solved in terms of, like, you know, they've got three attackmen who can dodge. And, you know, Leo Johnson is going to dodge. He's going to dodge the pass. You know, Brandow is going to dodge the score. Chris Lyons, like, he's just going to the goal. Now, he's better at it off the catch, but he can square you up and do it. And then you have Brad Sharp, who's a really good initiator. You have Thomas Bragg, who's basically just a range shooter. What I'm getting at is that, like, the hierarchy of the dodging, I think, still kind of needs to be sorted out. And so, you know, that's where I talk about zip and just like kind of playing with the requisite energy and particularly doing it right out of the gate. I mean, the element of this that I guess was surprising is that they were at home, right? It was their home opener. So to come out flat in your home opener is disconcerting. You know, but like I said, you can't overreact because you were in this exact same situation last year. And you know, for Penn State, it's kind of the same thing. You can't overreact positively because you were in this exact same situation last year. So, you know, I feel like they're better, right? But if they were that much better, then they should have beaten Villanova 2 weeks ago. So, you know, they're older, they're bigger, they're more athletic. They have a ton of organization to do defensively or work getting more organized. I'm going to watch this game and see if they made any personnel changes defensively after their first three games. You know, but ultimately what it comes down to is this is a really good rivalry. You know, it was a good rivalry before they played in the 2019 semifinals. And then that game was very contentious because Yale played one of the best quarters that we can remember a team playing. I think they were up 11-2 and it felt like they could win 40-4. And the final score ended up being, you know, kind of normal. I think it was like 19-11 or something like that. But now, you know, they've beaten them the last two times. So it's pretty clear to me that Penn State doesn't like Yale. And they play like it. So congrats to Jeff Tamburini's team.
And that's a kind of good and funny point is if you're going to drop a game, it might as well be to the team that you lost to last year before you had an incredible comeback. So you can craft some narratives, convince yourself, gaslight yourself a little bit, say, totally. Hey, this is what we do. We're a damn good team. As far as other games, notable Brown bounce. I think the Brown game's over at this point, but back against a Vermont team that is decent. One that Brown desperately needed. St. Joe won 100% of faceoffs, which should be illegal in their 19-6 win over Providence. And other than that, no real huge surprises for the rest of the weekend. Any takeaways or anything noteworthy?
You called the Merrimack was going to beat the Pioneers, and then that fell short.
Why did you have to bring that up? Of all the things. Shout out to Merrimack. They showed up to a hostile Denver team and played them close. So
yeah, Merrimack's good. It's not a dig. I mean, they were 3-0. They, you know,
sounded like
played
a
Dartmouth tough.
I'm defensive of Merrimack.
So no, it was a dig at you. It wasn't a dig at Merrimack. It was definitely a dig at you, though.
If so facto, a dig at Merrimack. So they're fun to watch, man. I tell you. Real quick, you want to touch on sixes?
Yes. Yeah, so I went to the practices and scrimmages on Tuesday, and then I went on Friday for that like final pool play action. Still haven't watched the semifinals, but I watched the championship earlier today. We're recording this on Sunday, in case you haven't figured that out by now. It's a lot, man. It's first of all, you know, I don't like to be too effusive in my praise, specifically of institutions like the Premier Lacrosse League, because it makes me sound like a shill. But great job by them. The fan experience was incredible.
Shill.
The venue is awesome, right? Just because it's four rows of bleachers that are elevated over the stands, great sight lines. The field does so much work because it's so small. It's so easy to see from the farthest corners, right? So that was awesome. But then, you know, they built out on both end zones. One end zone was a little bit more for families and kids. The other end zone was a little bit more for us drunken fools. And then on the far side, they had like their version of suites, which was basically just food and drinks for, you know, people that wanted to spend more on their tickets. And ultimately, it was awesome because it felt like, you know, pretty much everybody that went had some sort of like specialized VIP experience. So when you take the product on the field, which is really engaging, so fast that you cannot... It's almost like an excuse for having a short attention span, because even if you were so dialed, you can't absorb it all, right? So like if you just want to watch your, like look at your phone or whatever, like you can just completely miss it and you're going to absorb like 20% of what somebody who was totally locked in absorbed, including like the coaches and players themselves. And then it was a really cool experience. So I think kind of a home run for them. So I'm excited to see what they do with this concept going forward. As far as the game itself is concerned, you know, it's important to keep in mind this is not actually sixes because it has a 2-point line. And that makes it unique and interesting, but it is PLL sixes. It's very much a brand that is specific to them. My thing, and I'm going to leave it here because I know that you're going to pick up on this. That game is the best condemnation of field lacrosse as a development tool and then complement for box lacrosse as a development tool. Because what it really does is when you miss the goal on a shot in field lacrosse, nothing happens. There is no negative consequence. When you miss the goal in box lacrosse, it immediately switches into a test of your manhood to get the ball back, right? That is a negative consequence that it reinforces good habits like hitting the cage and not hitting the goalie. Sixes is a version that feels like field lacrosse with a very, very negative consequence if you miss the cage. And so, you know, I just was like, there are no Canadians playing this game. There are no Americans who play box lacrosse. So it was going to be like the most field lacrosse representation of the sixes discipline. And the shot selection was just so bad early on. And the execution in order to get good shots was so bad. And then, you know, the middle 2 days were just defined by the fact that the Atlas broke the game with the 2-point line. And the championship game was defined by the fact that, you know, Chrome came up with a game plan in order to mitigate it, right? So, you know, they basically instituted a full court press just to change things up, right? I don't think that they were really trying to get the ball back. They just wanted to change the tempo, make Atlas uncomfortable. And I think they did. It was perfectly timed. And then they just basically sold out to prevent Romar Dennis from getting his two bombs. And then, you know, really kind of like emphasized a lot of, you know, trying to limit Brian Costabile as a Dodger. It was a really interesting 5-day arc. What did you think of it?
I was ready to hate it. I was ready to be a hater, and credit to me. I put that aside and enjoyed damn near every second. I distinctly recall when, you know, when you have one of my best friends from high school, Walker, he's a baseball player, and he would support me and watch some of my college lacrosse games. And he goes, dude, for being the fastest sport on 2 feet, this shit's pretty slow. Like, there's a lot of downtime. I don't know why you guys are chasing the ball out of bounds like golden retrievers. This was a representation of it being the fastest game on 2 feet. I think the last 5 years have been relatively and objectively bad for professional lacrosse, just because the casual fan, hey, are you still playing for the Outlaws? No, that league folded. So are the Redwoods going to play the Outlaws? No, well, that's the PLL versus the MLL. That one folded, this one. Well, aren't you broadcasting for the Seals? Well, that's an indoor one. Hey, I just saw lacrosse on ESPN. What's that? Well, it's the PLL, but it's a different kind of lacrosse now. So once the water settles, I think that sixes should be the premier way to do youth development. I think that first to eighth grade should generally be sixes. I'm not ready to say that college or high school should ditch field and go with sixes. I think that
that's for sure not.
Not yet.
No, that not means, not so, ever. Not ever.
To the
not
to
ever.
The casual fan, to the growth of the sport, to every for every relevant and important metric. I enjoyed sixes so much that I think there's a significant chunk of field lacrosse that needs to be replaced by sixes. And I was not ready to say that going in. And if you were a casual fan watching it, it made a hell of a lot more sense than tuning into the PLL championship or the college national championship. It took the best parts of box and transferred it to the field. I still think box is the best way to consume lacrosse just because it's such an easy comparison to hockey. But I think field was a massive step in the right direction for casual fans to give a shit.
A lot of spicy takes. It's a good note to leave it on. You got to catch a flight.
I do got to catch a flight. My Uber's 5 minutes away. I love you, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and we'll be back next week.
And don't forget, send us good news and good people doing good things.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.